Okay, we're so glad you're back with us for another Gold Nugget segment brought to you by GoldSeek.com Radio. Today's special guest, Bob Hoy from Institutional Advisors. Joining me with his unique technical and fundamental outlooks, it's Bob Hoy, editor and chief investment strategist of InstitutionalAdvisors.com. Welcome back, Bob Hoy.
Chris, good to be with you. And we live in interesting times.
That's right. You know, we've seen one of the most impressive rallies in gold and silver, as well as the XAU, in, well, over the course of the last 15, 20 years. The bears would argue that it is a bounce, if you will, a rebound from deeply oversold conditions.
Yeah, well, what we were looking at in November was that all the commodity side metals, base metals and precious metals, and crude and grains and all that sort of stuff were getting really kind of oversold. So what we called it was a rotation, that some of the very high flying stocks would stop flying, and that we called them the low flyers on the resource side would set a bottom maybe December and then rally up into the spring. Some of the rallies have been absolutely fabulous. Some of our favorite juniors have really jumped, and that has worked out. So what we're looking at now on the near term is that for the gold, leading gold and silver stocks have reached pretty good momentum. And on one of our models, Silver Standard has reached an exhaustion mode. So it had been a whole lot faster and better than what we thought was possible. And our advice now on the precious metal sector would be to take some money off the table for those who are nimble enough to do it. And if you can't, there's going to be a bit of a setback for a while. It's just, Chris, it's been so good. And I've seen there one of my favorites from $1.01, it's sort of the lows in December, to $1.95. I mean, does it get any better? So that's the view. So, but on the bigger picture, and we're looking at financial history here, where we are completing the first bull market and the first economic expansion out of a classic 1929 crash. I mean, it was almost as bad as that. It was all, and there was a previous one as well, 1873. It was an outstanding crash and contraction. So our view on this first business expansion was that it would be a weak recovery, but we didn't really have an idea of how long it would go. But now we're at 5 years since the panic ended, and that panic was in lower grade bonds and in stocks, and that ended in March of 2009. The recovery business side, the economic side, came in real fast because the NBER decided that the recession was over in that June. So let's look at here. We've now got 5 years on a bull market, and that bull market includes lower-grade bond, and you're also 5 years on an economic expansion. Now, some of the economist guys think that you have to have, to conclude a business cycle, you've got to have a pretty strong economy. But our case is that in a post-bubble contraction, you won't get a strong economy, and the timing would be more the determinant on it, and we're at 5 years. Then also on the orthodox investment world with stocks, which became very overbought and with great sentiment figures in January. And these are at reached levels that you only see at a cyclical high for the stock market. And in the past, whenever these have been reached, you don't sort of have a 15% setback, and then the major senior indexes then start to trade sideways. You have to go through the whole cycle, and one of the conditioners on that, of course, is the credit cycle. where you had credit instruments, the lower grade ones, absolutely devastated in February, March, 5 years ago. We're now up there in Never Never Land. You got yields for junk bonds below 6%. Default rate has been low, so and the momentum has been high. So let's just take a look at the junk bond, JNK. And it recently got up to an RSI of 73, and that hasn't been seen since the 1st of May a year ago, when a seasonal rally topped out and was followed by a pretty hard slam in lower-grade bond prices. So what we have here now is you've had, right at, in early January, the spread, the credit spreads, and as we would like to joke, for equity people, there's only two times when you want to look at credit spreads, and that's at the bottom of a panic, and the other is at the high confidence of a market top, which we are now. So we've had some widening of credit spreads that hasn't been seen since 2008. That's serious. And there's been a hit, and then a little confusion with the problems in Crimea and Ukraine, and then things have been positive this week, but the credit spread side is vulnerable. And the way we relate that to the precious metals market is that in a business expansion, the gold shares don't do so well because the ordinary stock market is doing very well. And then in the post-bubble contraction, when you eventually get the real price of gold going up and profitability returning to most operations, then you can have a real bull market for the stock. And so here we are. You have had a fabulous bull market for stocks and low-grade bonds. You've had at times a very dismaying bear market for the precious metals. And on the big picture, we'd say that the bear market for precious metals probably has ended, but it's going to be bottoming for a while. And at the same time, you've had the blow-off, in which is still on, in stocks and bonds. So on an ideal world, as the big stock market rolls over, this will bring in the next phase of weakening economy and weakening resource prices and everything else, and in which case, in a post-bubble credit contraction, the gold sector has done the best, and we're looking forward to that. It may take us, Chris, maybe 5 or 6 months before we get into a strong market based on a post-bubble contraction. So, but we like the sector for the long term.
Very good. Well, you know, the gold stocks are typically viewed as leveraged plays on the precious metals. So far, 2014 has been very kind to the XAU after several difficult years. It's really one of the hottest sectors. I wonder if you could tell listeners what has renewed or piqued your interest in these precious metal stocks.
Well, that they were wrung out and dead dull in December. And but you know, you had two in here. That the one that led the market was, believe it or not, was the Silver Standard, SSIR in the States, and it had its low in October, and then everything else was having lows in December, and it came down and was testing low. Also, Pan American Silver, PAAS, was another good trading silver stock that was sort of in December beginning to resist the decline in other silver stocks and the decline in the gold stocks. And we looked at it and said, hey, and we consider those, not unkindly, but just as the dogs of the silver market, and we said if the dogs in the silver market are stabilizing, this has got to be saying something's developing good in the market. So, and now you've got Silver Standard up to an RSI of 75, yeah, 75. And when it's that high, the best of the move is in. So it's lots of momentum. Of course, sentiment's been good. So we think that on a near-term basis, the best is in for the explosive move out of Christmas time. and one could take some money off the table and look for opportunities in a few months' time. You started off by wondering about inflation and deflation, and if you got a minute, we could do a quick one on that. The thing about that the interventionist economists and central banks get all confused about is that in their mind, inflation is only a rise in the consumer price index and the wholesale prices behind that. They just don't grasp that you can have inflation in financial assets. So there's a lot of people in our business are looking at the horrendous recklessness of the central banks, and particularly the Fed. And there's an idea that somewhere in a year or so, all of that recklessness is going to come out and drive commodity prices to the moon. But our view is sort of based on history, and we realize that an aggressive central bank has to have a bid for speculative assets in order to get the money supply out. And as we've noted from 2011 until this winter, there wasn't much of a speculative bid in precious metals. But the inflation was going on pretty strongly in stock and lower-grade bond prices. So this plus a revival in real estate essentially provided the speculative bid that the Fed needed in order to get its money supply out. So I think it's going to be like 2008 when all the paper goes down, then the Fed can't inflate, and they then have a problem. So I think that what I can leave our listeners with is that if people have got to understand financial asset inflation and tangible asset inflation, and sometimes they go together and sometimes they don't. And in back in the first part of, I think it was April or May of 2011, we have an unusual long-term indicator, and it went up and gave the signal that the speculation in then commodities and precious metals was on a huge speculative surge, unique. Hadn't been seen, well, you know, in ages, back in the 80s and 70s. So anyways, that then suggested at least a cyclical bear market for base and precious metals, which we have had. And that indicator, unfortunately, doesn't work. It only works at tops. It doesn't give you really good bottoms. So we can't at this stage call that this is an important low for many commodities, but they now have reached, like coffee went from $1.01 to, I don't know, $2.06. So all of these reached blow-off conditions in a brief time. But so we're not calling for a new bull market in most commodities, but we would be looking for a new bull market in precious metals based on the next contraction as it comes in. Now, this then gets us into wondering about the difference between silver and gold. And when you're on a bull market for both those metals, silver will outperform gold. And this is reliable. So, but on this rally out of Christmas, silver has not been outperforming gold. So our view is that if you look at the gold-silver ratio, and it's about 65 now, it's 56. I'll just bring that up in a moment here. Get so many numbers. Yeah, 65. If it trades above 66, which is the resistance, then silver will be seriously underperforming gold. And oftentimes when you're going into a problem in the credit market, silver will do a sudden drop relative to gold, and that's one of the signposts. So, and it has a tendency when it's sort of acting like a credit spread to overwhelm all the guys who look at supply-demand analysis on the metals. So we're watching that one. Like I say, if it gets right through 56 and into 57, that would be suggesting that the next credit contraction is coming along, in which case silver would underperform gold.
I'd like your big picture outlook, if you could, please. This concept that we may be in a worldwide bubble on many different indices, everything ranging from the bond bubble that you've talked about on the show, as well as equities, and let's not forget that multi-trillion dollar market currencies.
Chris, this is a bubble of expectations, and people are desperate to get as much money out of financial instruments as they can, particularly low-grade bonds. This is reaching for a yield that is just incredible. And then you've had, a five-year bull market in stocks, and that's really good. But you are also on a bubble in politics. And this is showing up particularly in the interventionist economic side and central banking. These guys are absolutely desperate to prove that their theories that they can manage the economy are correct. We all know that they're not. So you might get an unraveling on that on a cyclical basis. Now, the other political mania out there is this global warming thing. And the IPCC, which is the body that was set up by the United Nations back in the 90s, and it was sort of straightforward at the beginning. They put together this committee to assess all of the papers and data out there on climate change and then come up with recommendations. But it became corrupted by people who want to build big government. So the only answer to these perceived problems in global warming or climate change is a bigger state. So they intend to change the world's climate through fascism, because as Mussolini described, fascism is the combination of big business and big government. So, and it's a wonderful story for ambitious governments. But here we are. We're running into. Actually, I took a degree in geophysics years ago, and of course, within the field is ice ages, and the understanding of ice age and mechanism really fell into place in the 70s and 80s. Essentially, the amount of energy from the sun and the amount of energy that reaches the Earth's surface, and you had the highest solar output in more than 1,000 years, sort of peaking back in the 60s and 70s. More recently, solar cycle 23, which had an unusual low a number of years ago, was the lowest solar cycle since the early 1913s, or since the 1913s. And it was interesting, because the other day I wrote down a note that if you take the January, February months in the contiguous United States, it's now clocked. Guess what? The coldest January and February since 1913. So we have Mother Nature working on some cooling, and the average temperature of the globe, whichever one you want to look at, essentially been going sideways for 17 years, and this was predictable because two solar physicists, Matt and Penn and Livingston, back in the late 90s, had done work on the sun and had suggested that the sun was going to go into a solar minimum for some time, which has worked out. And of course, anybody who took any physics would know that as the heat from the sun declines, the temperature in the Earth is going to stop going up. So the fascinating thing, Chris, is that Mother Nature is tending to those who have the audacity to imagine that they can control the climate of the Earth. And the other thing is that Mother Nature in the financial markets came in with a 1929 or 1873 type of crash. Even the establishment said that this was the worst recession since the 1930s, and they're looking at the recovery. I got no problem with the recovery that's been on for 5 years, and they're saying that it's been the weakest since the 1930s. So Mother Nature's providing an instruction there. So they've been crazy, these interventionists, and but I think they're going to have another comeuppance. So we'll see what happens to this cooling trend that has been on. And remember, I know we didn't talk about it, but even the summer months were unusually cool within the contiguous United States, with something like about 2,500 weather stations reporting record lows and about 700 weather stations reporting record highs. So I think this cooling regime will continue, and it'll at some point instruct governments about their ambitions. And then we don't know when it's going to start. The next business contraction, who knows, 2 or 3 months from now, we might have a better reading on it. And here's where the public's going to take a look at the government and say, look at trillions of dollars you put us on the line for in order to make a perfect economy. And we have horrendous unemployment numbers, and now we're in, when we get there, another recession. So I think that we're on the close to the start of a new age for a new bull market for common sense, and all the public has to do is take a look at what's going on. If temperatures continue to not advance according to the theories, then the theories are wrong. And if we get a recession, and despite all the efforts by interventionist central banks, then their theories are wrong, and eventually the public's going to grab it, and it'll be great. So you can mark me down as being an optimist. On the political side, the experiment in authoritarian government has been on for more than 100 years. It started in the early 1900s.
I think it began there with The Creature from Jekyll Island, of course.
I'm rereading that one now, particularly the introduction about how those guys quietly and secretly snuck down to have their meetings, and J.P. Morgan's man and Warburg, various people.
You know, it's so funny you should mention that, because I guess it passed in 1913, but I think it took a couple of years, and they finally pushed it through. I believe it was on Christmas Eve, or at least the Christmas break of 1913, when most of the representatives were simply back home.
It was snuck through, and they opened the doors in January 1914, and the depreciation of the U.S. dollar since then, I think it's now down to about 3.5 cents.
Very close, yeah, about 96.5% lost purchasing power due to the just unshackling from a precious metal standard. I mean, there's just inevitable. I mean, I guess it's a broken record now, but that when you unshackle a currency from some type of standard that's based in something tangible like gold or silver, preferably, I think you'd agree, a bimetallic standard, which we had for quite the longest time. And you might recall back in the 1800s that amazing speech, "We'll not be crucified on this cross of gold."
Oh, that was William Jennings Bryan, something close to that. And also, he in Wilson's cabinet was the Secretary of the Navy, I think, or something like that. And he invited the Swiss Navy to a big deal.
And you know, what was really going on there is that the moneyed banking interests on the East, they preferred the gold standard, whereas the farmers and the smaller mom-and-pop SNLs and bank branches throughout the Midwest, and yeah, much of the country, they preferred the silver standard because it was the money of the everyday farmer and the everyday person. And so then William Jennings Bryan came along and said, we can't allow this. And he just narrowly missed being elected. And as a result, you know, the moneyed interest essentially grabbed control of the monetary standard. I mean, we can go all the way back to the foundation of the country, where we've had numerous banking wars.
Wildcat banking break out against land in 1837, and then there was another wildcat banking in 1857. But, you know, if you want to look at the really big picture, I mentioned that we're 100 years plus in this experiment in authoritarian government, and there, in 2,000 years there's only been two other examples. And in what would be called the senior economy, and the first one was the 3rd century in Rome, where it had been a republic, and then it was sort of an empire, but it took 100 years, from 200 to 300 AD, to really trash it and turn it into a police state. And then it collapsed. But then the next outbreak in high inflation and authoritarian government was in the 1500s, where it was the conquered bullion that came over from the New World. Spain was the supreme power, and that experiment, unlimited government, required unlimited funds, and so they depreciated the currency and borrowed money like crazy, went defaulted about three times during the 1500s. So the illustration is that when you're on an experiment in unlimited government, even unlimited inflation eventually comes to an end. So the whole purpose of the Fed has been to fund another experiment in unlimited government. So we want to go back to see the motivation of what really caused the corruption in Rome in the 3rd century. And well, what it was is the ambition of the bureaucracy. They liked running things, and they saw all that wealth that had come in through conquest and tribute. But it wasn't enough to satisfy ambition, so then they took to a horrendous price inflation, and they destroyed the economy. Practical people left.
Exactly, and let's not forget how they debased the currencies by slowly removing the precious metal and diluting. Of course, they had a massive military, as we know today. I mean, they had military outposts as far as Scotland. The parallels are striking.
The ambition of the bureaucrats destroyed it. And eventually people left. And you know how long it took? 100 years. So here we are now. And then in the 1500s, it took a little over 100 years before the public figured it out and said enough of big government, so that your early 1600s was a nasty time in Europe, but it was less nasty in England, where the public eventually ended the inflation and ended the authority of the state, and you eventually had, in 1688, the Glorious Revolution, where they took on Charles II, and 1688, sorry, James II, and he was authoritarian, he was Catholic, and he was going to bring in French troops to subdue British citizens, and business interests in London said no. And they went over to Holland and got William of Orange. He came over. They appointed him king. People rallied around him. And as somebody said at the time, it was a close-run thing. And then that was the end of absolutism in England. So here we are now in the United States. You have the equivalent of a British king in heading up the White House on a absolutely the absurd experiment in order to destroy the middle class and destroy the economy of the United States. Talk to liberals, they can't believe it, but if you read about Saul Alinsky, you know what this guy's up to. But he still, like either Philip in Spain or King James in England, they have to face the financial market.
As we bring this all together today, we were hearing similar things in the 70s and early 80s, that the end was nigh, currencies would be destroyed, it would fill your backyard filled with junk silver, and people are still digging up yards and putting in pipes today and finding huge stockpiles of silver that had been essentially buried back in the 70s and early 80s. So can you tell folks and listeners today who are convinced that maybe we are close to the end game, tell folks how it's different now 30, 35 years later?
I was there, and these concerns, you wanted to buy extra cans of groceries, and you wanted to have a little place away out in the bush where you could be away from the threat. But the threat is in Washington, D.C. The threat is in Ottawa, Canada, or the threat is in Sacramento, California, you know, the state capitals. And there's a devolution developing here whereby in California, for example, you've got different regions want to break away. The public wants to get away from the authoritarians in the big cities. And it's a very healthy move. And the middle-class people have got to stop and fight it. In the 70s and 80s, the idea of having a retreat somewhere was running away from it. Now, there's no place to go because back in the 70s, you could believe that there were banking havens in Switzerland or the Grand Caymans. You can't hide your money. You know, there's no place to hide. Even if you go up in the bush of British Columbia, the authoritarians can still get at you. So the beauty of it, Chris, is that the public, at least the caring public, the middle class who likes its lifestyle, has got to stand on its hind feet and say, no, enough. And so how's it going to do it? It's going to take a look on the next recession at the central bankers and say, out of here. And perhaps they will even force a gold standard, in which case the public is selecting the money it chooses to transact in. And then the same with you get another a year or so of not advancing global temperatures, and the public's going to take a look at the government and say, you guys were over your head. You didn't know what you're talking about. You're out of here. So I think that the change can happen politically. The public will seek self-government. I mean, America was started on the concept of self-government. And the ambitions of the current White House as well, Obama and his teleprompter know how to run your life. So he's even said that he knows more about policy than his policy advisors do. So this is a crazy experiment, and it will fail. And the public has the ability to determine that failure. You look at in Eastern Europe in the 80s, they took a look in East Germany, saw what the governing classes, how they were living, and looked at the promises from the governing classes, looked at the amount of money they were taking out of the system, and said, enough. And they stared down border guards with AK-47s. And the point then is that if you go back to 1956 with the Hungarian uprising, and the Soviets sent in the tanks, and there was great bloodshed. In 1968, the folks in Czechoslovakia, particularly in Prague, had a taste for freedom, and they sent in the tanks, and it was bloody. Now, in the late 80s, it was the same uprising for freedom, and at one time, Jaruzelski, who was the dictator in Poland, and Gorbachev talked about sending in the tanks, at least I read that, and they didn't. So, and they won't, and sure, you got a blow up in Ukraine now, but I take that as Russia's about to lose a key important part of its territory, Ukraine. They may keep the eastern portion, and they will definitely end up with that seaport. But this is another devolution. So in once the experiment in centralization ends, you have regions spinning apart, and you also have a shift in political sentiment away from central government and to the individual. We live in exciting times, very exciting times, and that's how we started this.
Well, it's been a very illuminating conversation. I wonder if you could tell folks more about the services you provide, as well as any contact information you'd like to share.
Stock markets, credit markets, metals, commodities and interest rates and precious metals, the whole thing, on a big overview basis. And then our technical work is absolutely outstanding. And they come out whenever there's trading opportunities. And like on Sunday, we came out with the huge valuations on the precious metals. So we're looking now for the correction. You can get in touch with us through institutionaladvisors.com, that's O-R-S at the end, or actually just Google B-O-B, H-O-Y, Bob Hoy, and it gets us into the system, and we have institutional subscribers, we have money managers, we've got mining people, and we have a lot of high net worth people, and you can take, we put people on the mailing list for 4 or 5 weeks, and if you like the service, you come on board.
And I understand that, Bob, that you might just have a couple of very interesting automobiles, vintage, classic cars that maybe one or two of our listeners today might not be able to do without. Tell us more.
Well, I'm at an age to have three old collector's cars is more than I need. So I have a 1962 Alfa Romeo Spider. That's the convertible. And this thing is set up for, it is still a very respectable handling sports car. It's got a later model 2-liter engine in it, so it's fairly quick. Then the other one is its brother, you might say, the Sprint Coupe. It's 1963. And both cars are concours classes. The convertible was in a serious concours and came in third place in the Italian, and the coupe is just sort of being finished from a multi-year restoration, and it's coming out as a concours car. So they're beautiful cars, and if anybody's interested, then just get in touch with me or through you, and I always love to talk about cars.
Isn't that something? I miss my car days. You know, the teenage years, I had a 74 Plymouth Roadrunner with a hood scoop on it, 344 barrel quadrajet with a slapstick transmission and a moonroof, a leather moonroof, and jet black interior with, yeah, the suede Naga hide seats were, everything was immaculate. And I bought it for $400. And I thought I was a rocket scientist when I sold it for $600. I made 50%. Unfortunately, if I'd held it, it'd probably be worth about $60,000 today.
Well, listen, I'll tell you how you offset that one.
Okay.
Just imagine the rent at $50 a month to have had it in the garage all through that. Chris, good to be with you. Look forward to the next one.